There it is.
It's Friday, so welcome to another edition of
Hey guys.
Friday at noon. Bitcoin Jam. We're back.
How are you?
I haven't seen you guys in a long time.
Been a little minute. Yeah.
I'm gonna
retweet this. Yeah, why not?
While you guys are retweeting, I'm super grateful
Oh yeah, we've been live for 20 seconds.
Seriously, with this cold temperatures, I'm doing so much better this morning. So,
and you are not retweeting because you have got no Twitter on your phone and you forgot your password.
Well, I didn't forget my password. I intentionally
excluded yourself.
Anjali has my password.
Through Notion?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
So she could log in theory.
If something really
If I really needed to, of course, I could go through the email reset. But that's like, you know, I'm not going
to. So you're making it purposely annoying.
It's extremely challenging. Yeah.
And how's your life? How much FOMO do you have?
Like, honestly, I would say my life is at least 50% better.
But you have nothing to contribute to the show today.
Oh, dude, I got a lot to contribute to the show today. I got so much. Well,
you don't know what happened this week.
So it's a little unfair for me because I still use Twitter. I just use it secondhand. But like anything interesting, Anjali will send me a screenshot. You guys will send me stuff.
So we are your algorithm.
Y'all are my AIs.
Yeah.
So, you know, thank you. Yeah. I'm living off of the largesse of my dear compatriot here. But I will say, like, it definitely. And the other thing is Stacker News. Like, anything interesting enough, like, generally will find its way to Stacker News. So. Shout out to Stacker News.
What is the vibe with the MicroStrategy stretch stuff on Stacker News? Does that ever make it there? Because I know you're a bit of a fan, and I think Stacker News, I get the sense is like more hardcore, you know, Bitcoiner vibe and a little less kind of financialization.
That's an interesting point. I would say, well, the beauty of Stacker News is one, the community there, I would say, how do I say this nicely? If like the average IQ on Twitter is here, Stacker News is probably here. So it's definitely, I would say, it's definitely a more nuanced, reasonable place where I would say in general, it leans much more sort of builder, you know, interested in the technology and products. But people are not just like screaming and haters.
But
like,
Darthcoin.
Well, Darthcoin is a special guy. And,
less bots, but I mean, that's typical.
It's a smaller community.
Because small community.
Yeah. But
I'm not convinced Stacker News design, it might.
I agree with you in general. The smaller community explains a lot of it. I also think it's just self-selected, you know, because early adopters were people like me, and they tended to be more builders, more thoughtful. So I think those are showing, but I am starting to notice, you know, downvoting is getting or down zapping where, you know, so the whole thesis of Stacker News is you tie information to its market value. So you're creating markets for information. And, you know, it's definitely been a slow roll, but it's really picking up. Like people are now like, I don't want to like say actual names, but there's a cast of characters in the Darthcoin camp, let's say on different sides. And when people come and just start screaming the same thing over and over, people immediately downvote it. And you can still see it. It's not like it's censored, but you have to click the eyeball button to like surface it. And so, I would say the incendiary, just kind of like unreasonable comments generally do get downvoted.
Paid shadow banning.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. But it's not just like, it's not just the highest dollar amount. I mean, at least, I mean, Kian's been doing a lot of experimentation, so I don't know what it currently is, but there is like a web of trust component to it. So you build reputation on the site. And so, you know, maybe I zap 100 sats and someone else zaps 1,000, but, you know, or vice versa. But if they have a higher reputation, it might count.
And you have to zap the downvote too, right?
That's right. So it's like you have to really care.
Does that downvote does a downvote zap go to the creator or curator of that?
That's a great question. I actually have no idea.
Because I once wrote something that got a little bit of uptake and I was like, wow, I actually like got a bunch of zaps for that. That's cool. But I couldn't imagine if my thing got a lot of downvotes, I should be getting those zaps.
Perhaps it goes to the community owner.
Otherwise, she's like this encouraging controversy.
Kian or Carr, if one of you guys are listening or someone else, maybe you can help enlighten us. But, you know, the concept is also, it's a really sort of cool concept that, again, is also slowly taking off and really getting some traction, which is, as you know, on Reddit, you're obviously, you know, the analogy is you're a sharecropper because you don't actually own if you're a mod, you don't actually own your territory. Or your whatever your sub, here is your territory, you can actually own it, so you can set the rules. So I would imagine there's some incentive for territory owners to collect those views.
Right.
But you brought up community on Stacker News might not be as favorable or might have more concerned about MicroStrategy or Stretch. We've also had a reply on X, someone not liking us talking about it in this show. They like us talking about building an innovation.
Yep.
But we also, for what it's worth, on the strategy show had at least double the views last week. So,
but Well, but we're not optimizing.
We're not optimizing or pandering for views.
We're optimizing.
I'm saying there's multiple metrics.
Yeah. There are multiple metrics. And actually, I mean,
I tend to agree.
The primary metric is what the fuck we're feeling.
Our main metric is
let's have fun.
Have fun and talk about what we want to talk about. And we tend to like building an innovation.
Yep.
Yeah.
The finance aspect, the technical aspect.
We like
did a deep dive on Bitcoin core features last week. So we sort of,
I think it's all interesting.
We go all over the place. Someone I was speaking to the past week, they said they like the show. I asked for any, constructive criticism or improvement, and they wanted, they wanted to hear more Bitcoin, maybe less AI or whatever, but whatever. We're going to go with what we go. The nice thing about the show, you don't have to listen to it live and suffer through all 90 minutes.
You can, although if you do, you can leave comments like Vinny and Ryan Brown right now.
You can watch it afterwards and Alex and crew do a great job of timestamps with really good titles. So you can just like click to what you want. And I think we have a really cool topic index that will be available soon.
AI software, home built, right?
Yeah.
Grown AI software.
We're getting some feedback from the audience Less basketball, for sure. Bro, we don't talk about basketball.
I used to like Graham, and now, man.
Please.
Yeah. Keep covering digital credit from Ryan.
That encourages me to talk more about Iowa State basketball. But
so have you watched Wemby?
Yeah. Wemby. Wow.
Yeah, we are all witness.
I'm actually going to the...
Rom, you brought this on, dude.
I know, he brought it on. It was his mistake. I'm going to the Caitlin Clark game next Thursday.
You're a big Caitlin Clark fan.
Well,
it's the second time you've done this.
I went last summer too.
Okay.
And she shot 0-for-7 from 3. It was the first time she's ever not made a 3 in a game.
Nice.
She plays here once or twice a year. So I'm going to go.
Okay.
Go see her again. I mean, she's from Iowa. So I've known about her since she was like a seventh grader.
There is a real connection.
And she was, But then she played for the Hawkeyes, and I hate the Hawkeyes, but I overcome that hate to, she's pretty special player. So anyway, we don't have to talk about basketball. but what I wanted to discuss though, it's not just Stacker News, maybe. I didn't even know there was negative sentiment there, but like just my own team, Spiral. Mm-hmm. And then I saw Robin Linus, tweeted out saying that Strategy is SBF on steroids. And I
really, I have a high opinion of Robin.
I have a high opinion of Robin. No, love Robin. He's a Spiral grantee.
Yeah.
Love Robin. And that was, that's a strong statement.
Yeah.
Because it implies fraud.
Yeah.
Because SBF is literally in federal prison for fraud. And it's very there's, as far as I'm aware, there's zero evidence that the money going into any of the Strategy equities is just being spent elsewhere and not being held in Bitcoin.
Well, I mean, which is strong evidence to the contrary, actually.
Yeah, I mean,
there's corporate governance that shows
pretty good evidence that it's stored at Coinbase and other custodians.
Yeah.
I mean, it could improve. We talked about
proof of reserves.
Saylor has not been keen on doing proof of reserves, and like River and Cash App and others and many other exchanges are doing that.
Do you know why that is?
I don't know why. So
I mean, he's made some claims before. Like, for example, that like if people know where it is, one, he claims it heightens risk. I guess it's like getting
concentrated.
Two, he claims that it's not necessarily good for like the company because let's say for some reason they need to like, even like reshuffle from one address to the other, the market might panic sell. They think he's selling.
Right.
I mean, they're reasonable arguments, but I prefer proof of reserve as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think net-net, I don't buy those. I mean, I buy those arguments, but the net-net, I think, I don't agree with the conclusion. I'd like to see him do that. But in any case, there's really anyone paying attention. There's just, I don't think it passes the sniff test that there's fraud.
Yeah.
I think it is reasonable, though, if you haven't studied it. Like, it sounds concerning. I think for everyone, though, even if you're bullish on Strategy, owning 4% of Bitcoin is just generally unhealthy for Bitcoin. I agree with that. Like I agree in an ideal world, you could wave a magic wand and there's not one person or entity that owns that much Bitcoin because that level and higher is unhealthy for Bitcoin. But although
to be fair on that point, like just, I mean, I agree in the abstract, but comparing that today with like even a couple of years ago, I mean, there were whales that held that much, right? And so arguably some of those whales selling, going to an institution, at least with an institution, in theory, there's like corporate governance. In theory, there's multiple shareholders. So I agree with you. I would prefer to see less concentration on the whole, but if there's going to be concentration, it's probably better in like the hands of a public company than one dude.
Yeah, I agree with that relative comparison. In any case, but I mean, my view, and I suspect you guys agree, like it or not, it's permissionless money, and there's nothing. There's nothing we can do to stop that.
And that's, in a sense, like a good thing.
That's the whole point.
That's kind of the whole point.
Yeah, exactly.
Then we can separately. So what, like it or not or whatever, it's like kind of like, you know, it's permissionless money. So that in and of itself, it's valid.
Yeah.
Then we can also evaluate what they're doing with it and come up with our own opinion on whether we think that's a valid use case. And that's an opinion.
Yeah.
I think all three of us agree that it's also a valid use case and an interesting use case too. That's where, though, I think reactions of other people, including engineers, my own team, and maybe what Robin is feeling, is that a sense that, like, well, number one, 4% is a big number, and that's unhealthy. Okay, agree. In the abstract,
sure.
But then also, like, they have a lot of leverage. If it blows up, it's collateral damage for everyone in Bitcoin, for everyone else's use cases. So I agree with that hypothetical risk. And I think we all have to agree, it can blow up. It can definitely blow up. Mm-hmm. The interesting discussion is, what's the likelihood of that? And that's where I think that, like, we have studied it enough to think that it is low probability of blowing up in the short to medium term. And for it to blow up long term, things have to be really dire in Bitcoin. Yeah. Something to the tune of, 7 years out, Bitcoin's price is much lower than it is today. Is that possible? Sure, that's possible. And if Bitcoin were 10 or 20K in 7 years, that's where it starts to get into territory where it could blow up. But I would also say, if in 7 years, Bitcoin is 10 to 20K, most other use cases and dreams of Bitcoin are already kind of in shambles anyway. I think there's one sentiment, there's a sentiment though that, like, forget about the price, Bitcoin, it's censorship resistant money. And it works no matter what the price is. I mean, I agree with that in that Bitcoin scales up and down, but that's a world in which it's super niche. Like, just a few people around the world can transfer value. Bitcoin's maybe like $100 a coin or something. There's almost no hash rate, almost no fees or demand. And it's kind of a joke of a project, to be honest at that point.
Yeah.
What does that future look like? Like, if you had to imagine how it could get to be that, let's assume, maybe Strategy blows up or something. What is the other backstop? Like, what's the number two? Is it the Chinese yuan or the dollar regain strength, or what? How would that world look?
Or gold-backed currency.
Or gold, yeah.
You're saying if Bitcoin blows up for whatever reason, then what would take its place and what we're imagining it, the purpose it serves in the world?
Yeah.
Just more of the same
more
of
the
what
same.
We've
yeah.
what we've had, right?
I think I remember many years ago, I think actually Wences put out an essay, which was really nice, talking about like the probabilities of like different outcomes for Bitcoin. There's the probability of it takes over and becomes a global reserve asset. There's the probability that it goes to absolute zero. And then there was this probability that it kind of becomes, like you're saying, this sort of like niche product that, like, you know, the nerds and anarchists mm-hmm. and like dark web people are using. And that to me is the, like, it goes to the 10K, 20K, for a very long extended period of time. Like, it's still there and people will still use it, but it'll probably be used for more illicit things or, like, nerds on the internet, and like, that's fine. But I think that some of people don't think about that you mentioned is, in that world, if price doesn't continue to go up over time, hash rate will fall. And as hash rate falls, and something, maybe we'll discuss more today as well, because it's been coming to me from various friends and in different formats, is the security budget goes down. That the security budget goes down, then it becomes a lot easier to hack. And if it becomes a lot easier to hack, or 51% rollback attack, then how useful is it really for anything other than, bizarre missions?
Definitely get into that.
Yeah.
Um,
so
But yeah, the reason I brought up, or you brought it up, but I was hoping to talk about MicroStrategy and Stretch. One is just to speak to this audience that are definitely legitimate people in Bitcoin and they have a concern. And so just speak to my interpretation of their mindset and concerns. Mm-hmm. And the reason, a reason I think it's important for us to talk about it on the show, and just for, in general, anyone in Bitcoin to talk about this, isn't to try to strategy pill everyone. I don't care if anyone else buys a strategy stock or whatever. I'm not shilling it. But as any Bitcoiner, I think should at least understand it to some extent, because it does own 4% of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So whether you're a fan or a hater, it's important to understand it, because to their point, if it blows up, it'll be all of us suffer collateral damage.
Yeah.
So that's why everyone should be, I think, be aware of it. And to the degree that it's just sort of, someone hasn't spent that much time studying it and just has this high level view of lots of leverage, lots of risk, could blow up any minute or whatever, I don't think I agree with that view. And I don't think you guys either. So if our understanding is correct, and that it's very low probability of short to medium term collapse, and long term we can articulate what that looks like, let's level up people's understanding.
Agreed.
Of that.
Yeah.
I actually want to touch on both how I've seen different people go through stages of understanding strategy, and then maybe we can actually talk about some of the specifics. We had an in-depth conversation together this week about sort of strategy, and I think there's specific scenarios that are worth highlighting. And so one thing I would just say is, for people that are skeptical, I'm in general very skeptical of these things too. I remember many years ago, and all my friends, and it's like, oh man, Andreessen's back, the new stable coin, it's an algorithmic stable, here comes Terra Luna, and I get all of those are freaking disasters. And I can see from one perspective how you might say, well, how is this any different? It's just a public company. But the thing is, it actually does have some key differences. I think those are worth discussing. One thing I'll say back to your original question on Stacker News is, there were a few people, and I forget this guy's name, it's Dinlap or something, Joachim Bock. I think he's a well-known writer for, I don't know if he's Financial Times or one of these guys. Maybe he's with the Bitcoin Policy Institute. I don't know. If someone's listening, you know what I mean. But he's a very active user in Stacker News. Very, very well-written, articulate articles. And at first, he, being a sort of financial guy, was very much a hater. And it was oh man, this is a scam. It's a Ponzi. And then every couple of weeks, he'd be all right, well, I just learned they actually have more coverage than I thought. And then he'd be well, oh shit. As long as they have whatever, 40 years of coverage, I actually don't see how this thing could blow. Oh, and now he's kind of I don't like it in general, but doesn't seem like it's actually going to blow up. So I've seen, anyone that starts doing real homework and looking into the actual metrics here, a lot of their risk factors, and that's not to say there are none, there are clear risk factors here, but the ones that they perceive just by at a glance associating with something like a Terra Luna or one of these algo stable coins is not really there. So I think that's worth saying. A couple of things that I picked up from our conversation this week and deep dive is, when at a very high level, and I think it's important to understand that these numbers can change over time. So you have to keep watching what strategy is doing. Doesn't mean they're always going to be good actors, but in general, he's aiming Saylor for at least a 3-to-1 coverage ratio of, 3x the amount of Bitcoin for every $100 of Stretch that he's issuing, with a slight cash reserve on top. And the cash reserve can always pay those dividends as well. And so when you start to actually do the math, and I think he's actually over that 3x right now, but if you start
4.5.
Yeah, it's 4.5. So if you start to do the math on this, you start to realize, he, even if Bitcoin does nothing for many years, he has the ability, and he never buys any more Bitcoin, to pay, I think it's 39 or 40 years of the dividends as it stands today. And, that seems pretty reasonable. And one thing you brought up in a chat that we had a couple of weeks ago in Signal is, you're like, well, it could still be, Ponzi. And I push back on the Ponzi thing, because in my mind, a Ponzi is, I have to take money from Steve to pay DK.
I never said it was a Ponzi.
I thought you were into
I don't recall that.
Oh, anyways.
I'm certain I didn't.
Okay, well,
but,
okay.
But never, certainly other people have.
Yeah, other people
and
have.
It's definitely not.
Well, okay. So you were insinuating it could still be a Ponzi. We can go back and look at the records on this. Oh, well, because I remember I specifically came back and said, in order, there's a clear definition in my mind. Whatever you were saying, my response was, in order for it to be a Ponzi, I have to have new dollars to pay the other person. In this case, he may be taking new dollars to pay the dividends, But if he has the dollars and Bitcoin there that he can use to pay those dividends as well, he doesn't have to take in new money. Not a Ponzi.
They're not required. Because I just had this. So we had that group discussion on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I was even more emboldened to go to another friend group who I knew would be skeptics, right?
Right.
Close friends of mine.
Yeah.
Who understand general finance and how to analyze such things like assets and being able to pay dividends, et cetera, well. But some of them are Bitcoin skeptics. And then they sort of brought up, is it a Ponzi? Or like they have to keep getting people to buy Stretch to pay off the dividends for Stretch.
Exactly.
And like you just said, it's not required.
That's not true.
Number one, they can sell debt or equity of MicroStrategy. And number two, Bitcoin can appreciate. So there's certainly a world where they literally take on no more debt or equity MicroStrategy, no more Stretch. They don't sell any more Stretch. And they can still pay off all the dividends to all their stakeholders in perpetuity.
That's
just
right.
Because Bitcoin appreciates. So the primary risk you're taking with this is that you have to assume Bitcoin appreciates over time.
Yes.
Right.
And we can get into the details. Does it need to appreciate 3% or 12% a year or whatever? So that's an interesting analysis and discussion.
But you don't have to have wild expectations about what.
And it's also
modest expectations.
Modest.
Very
modest. Because whether it's 3 or 11.5%, both are modest for Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Also over long periods of time too.
Yeah. Yeah.
So one of the nice things about Stretch is it's resilient against short-term volatility and bear markets of Bitcoin. But we did in our discussion we did validate though something we talked about maybe a couple weeks ago, which was that everything else held constant, every dollar of Stretch purchase does increase the risk of paying future dividends. Mm-hmm. So it's important to understand that. And so, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't buy Stretch or think it's all going to blow up. It just has to be managed well.
Yeah.
The growth of Stretch, the assets under management for Stretch, it needs to grow commensurate with the price appreciation of Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And there's some window there and of acceptable risk, and that's kind of we could do an objective analysis to set our boundaries, but then within that window we might have different risk tolerance.
Yep.
Like you said, right now I think it's like 38.6 years. They have enough Bitcoin. If you take Bitcoin's current dollar price, they could pay off dividends for all of their Stretch customers for 38.6 years.
Yep.
So that's like an insane, if you're a naysayer, you might be like, well, Bitcoin could go to zero. Well, they also have a US dollar reserve too, which I think they originally set out for it to cover 2.5 years, and maybe it's like 1.25 years now or something. But in any case, people should definitely be aware of that risk. So something that could go wrong is if they don't execute well, and they get in over their skis, and they get greedy.
They get greedy. That's the risk.
Grow Stretch too fast.
Yep.
So anyone holding, that's another thing that came out of this discussion with some friends of mine. If you put money in like a CD or money market or savings or bonds, you don't have to pay attention really.
Yeah.
Maybe bonds, you kind of want to know what the market's going on, but with Stretch, you do want to pay attention.
Yes.
For at least a couple of reasons. One, are they getting greedy? Because if they're getting greedy and that 38.6 years goes to 30, to 20, to 10, and like the example I raised is like, well, they have $10.5 billion right now in Stretch. What if they are super successful in creating awareness around the incredible economics of it right now, and it grows to $300 billion?
Yeah.
Well, then that 38 years is basically 1 year.
Yeah.
And then I would be
they don't have to sell Stretch.
I'm saying if they get
greedy.
If they get greedy. Yeah. So
they could have
if they have the opportunity, if the opportunity knocks on the door today and they're like, here's $300 billion and they get greedy and it's enticing and they pull the trigger, I would, if I'm a Stretch holder, I would want to be aware of that. And if that 38 years goes to 1 year, I think then I would be like, that's too risky.
Right.
It's not a good investment then.
Don't we already have evidence, if I recall a few weeks ago, where there was excess demand for new Stretch than they were going to issue. Does that sound right?
I don't recall.
I think there was like, you know, $4 billion.
You call it a Ponzi, and I don't recall that either. So
okay. I'm going to show the screen.
You guys call screen chat because I remember in that group chat defining why it's not a Ponzi. Well, okay, I brought the definition.
So maybe you didn't say it was a Ponzi. Maybe you were referencing why someone else could still call it a Ponzi. Regardless, there was a debate over the word Ponzi. So we'll pull the record and Alex will show it up. Yeah.
The other, let's see, what was the other... other risk, say.
Okay, no, well, there's one other big difference
that's worth
covering. So that's the biggest risk is Coinbase and Anchorage or whoever they're using as custodians get hacked. That is a major risk. If you ask me what's the number one risk, they get hacked and lose the Bitcoin.
Yeah. Oh, I know the other risk. It was a new insight too, but someone said this week that around 4% of that 10.5 billion in Stretch is DeFi. Mm. So there's been like tokens.
The double looping, as we learned.
Yeah.
Tokens created on other blockchains that purchase Stretch and then they allow for leverage. And then you can leverage upon leverage upon leverage upon leverage. And
BitMEX done.
You know, take that 11.5% that Stretch pays and blow it up to like 30, 40% or more. I have no idea, whatever. If that grows to a larger percentage of Stretch, that is likely a systemic risk. I'd need to model that out more and get a sense for like, is the current 4% a risk? Does it need to be 10, 20, 50? I have no idea. And I also would want to play out the scenario of how that would manifest into blowing everything up. I haven't done that yet, but that's another risk to be aware of that I wasn't thinking about before. So again, if someone's like, if you're considering Stretch or Strategy, or again, even if you don't care about that at all, but just care about Bitcoin not blowing overall, being suffering this collateral damage, I think an important metric is to follow the DeFi percentage of Stretch.
Right. But just to be clear on that risk, I mean, I haven't thought deeply about this, but like someone still holds the underlying Stretch. I mean, even if I guess the idea would be if you over lever it, there's too much like downstream demand. If that blew up, that demand would drop.
People could get liquidated. They need to sell it. And there's a lot of selling pressure from all these loop-de-loops.
But even then, I think one of my big takeaways and the loop-de-loops where you can get like 30%, like, okay, that starts sounding a little too good to be true. But what I would guess is that we have, and to be clear, Saylor is encouraging the DeFi stuff a lot. I think he's going to keep encouraging it. But I think we have a long way to go before that systemic risk is even, I don't know, possible. Because one of my big takeaways is that from our conversation, the market for debt and credit is so much bigger than the market for equity. So we're talking, you know, if equities are 180 billion or trillion, I guess, this is 300 trillion plus. So it's, you know, double the size of that. There are, and right now he's what, $10 billion he sold or something like that? Like it's such a small drop of a drop of a drop in a bucket that I just, even if there was like a small systemic crash, I can't imagine, you know, institutions would come in, scoop it up for, you know, a discount and then whatever. Yeah.
In the future, I believe that, but right now I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Because 80% of Stretch ownership is retail. It does not appear that institutions yet are convinced this, because like we heard from someone showing some graphs, the Stretch price has not been pegged at a dollar consistently. And like today it's $98.40 or whatever. And it has dipped to like 90 and 83 or 80. I don't know. It's definitely dipped. It rebounds quickly, but if you're managing $1 trillion of like debt and you're used to bond markets, that graph looks insane to you, right?
Yeah, you want
like
a lot
you're not
more
if you're a Bitcoiner, you'd be like whatever.
Yeah,
but if you're managing $1 trillion of bonds, that is a very scary graph. So I'm not sure institutions.
And I think
they are
looking at Standard & Poor. What does Standard & Poor have to say? Do they think it's good? Is this blessed?
Yeah.
And if it's not yet blessed.
Hashtag.
That was funny though. Then, like it labels it a junk rating, and because they literally value the Bitcoin at zero. Yeah. So that just,
I guess,
me,
part of why
that just screams to me opportunity, right?
Exactly.
Because if you have confidence, if you have understanding and confidence that Bitcoin should not be valued at zero, then that rating is ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
So then if there's all this other money that avoids it because of that rating, I would say they're like naive. And if you understand that, then you can take advantage of it.
But I think part of why it's rated as zero is because he said, never sell your Bitcoin. And if you're never going to sell it, then you have to rate it as zero. It's like an asset that has no value, right? It's like an impaired asset. Whereas now he says, oh,
we could sell it, but
we might buy more. Now, okay, well, it actually has value in the market and that's recognized. And so I think over time, I don't know when this happens, but over time, you have to recognize that pile of Bitcoin is actually worth something.
So, I think it's also worth noting, Steve, your point on 80% being retail, that there's actually some nuance there, which I think is important. We actually don't know that a bunch of the institutions aren't here yet. Something I picked up from an interview with Saylor, one of the, I think, his CoinDesk interview, which was quite good, is I think there's like some rule where institutions, they need to be able to hold it for a minimum amount of time before they have to disclose that they're actually holding that instrument. So if some arbitrage, whatever is coming in, an arbitrage player like a Jane Street or Citadel or whatever, like in theory, they could come buy it the day before or sell it the day after and never need to disclose that. So we know 80% of retail are the long-term hodlers of this, but there actually might be a lot more institutional flow, I think, that's just short-term buyers. I actually think that's another super, super important point I want to cover as well, which is where is the liquidity for the Stretch product coming from? In the case of a stable coin like a Terra Luna, that was a deposit. And this is a big, big, important point. A deposit says anytime I can redeem I can redeem my dollar or my instrument for Bitcoin. That is kind of that was to me like the black and white difference between these products. That means if there's a run on the bank there, then they can have a spiral and die. In Saylor's case, there is no deposit. There is no guarantee. You cannot redeem it for Bitcoin. And so the liquidity is not being provided by Strategy. The liquidity is being provided by these market makers and probably by the big firms already, I would guess. And if not, very soon it will be. So that's like the number one most important point. I think people need to understand the difference, deposit versus not deposit. And when you start going down this line of thinking, people will start to face the uncomfortable truth, kind of like in that CoffeeZilla debate where, they think they're blowing it up and then they realize, oh shit, I actually don't understand this because there is a real Ponzi going on. It's just the Ponzi is banking. And that to me is the much bigger story. Anywhere where you have a contractual guarantee to get your deposit out and you can't, that's an issue.
I want to respond to a couple of comments. Yeah. So Vinny says, isn't Strategy a bet on a specific future action? Otherwise you get more Bitcoin per dollar today by holding the asset directly. And I don't think that's correct. I don't really know what you mean by specific future action, but
yeah.
We've largely been talking about Stretch, but if we talk about Strategy itself and Strategy equity,
like MSTR,
my understanding of the investment thesis for that is that that there's a corporate strategy on how to grow Bitcoin per share. So if you buy a share of MSTR, it's equivalent to so much Bitcoin, and you're making a bet that over time the Bitcoin you have is actually going to increase. Whereas if I just buy the underlying asset Bitcoin, if I buy one Bitcoin, I'm going to have one Bitcoin in the future. And with Strategy, if I buy so many shares and it's one Bitcoin, my expectation is that it's worth 1.2 Bitcoin or 1.5 or 2 Bitcoin in the future, depending on how they perform and how long I hold it. And some data we saw this week at least showed to date, they've been very successful at that. I think it was like around 4 years ago, it was something like 0.7 Bitcoin per share, and now it's like 2.1. So it's like a 3x increase in something like 4 or 5 years. And year to date this year, it's a 12% increase in Bitcoin per share, which is remarkable because number one, we're in a bear market.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We're at least not in a bull market, right?
We're in a bear.
The price of Bitcoin has declined year to date. Materially, and they've grown Bitcoin per share by 12%. And I don't think they've been selling equity and debt for MicroStrategy this year at all, or not much at all, because there's not demand, because that tends to be correlated with a bull market. So I believe that 12% increase is due to Stretch. So in any case, whether you believe in that thesis or not, that's my understanding of the thesis of Strategy. So It's like, and if that's a correct thesis and it plays out and they execute, then you'd have more Bitcoin than if you just bought the underlying asset.
More Bitcoin per share.
Per share.
You'd have the shares. You wouldn't have the Bitcoin. So I think, you know, making that distinction is worth it. You're playing a fiat game and you're hoping to increase your Bitcoin per share. And
your IOU for that.
Your Bitcoin derivative exposure.
But conceptually, that's why one would do it versus the underlying asset. Mm-hmm. And then what was the other? Oh, also what matters though is what your entry point, meaning, you're laughing at me because I had a bad entry point into Strategy. But the MNAV, right? So if you buy into Strategy and it's you're paying like twice the US dollar price for Bitcoin than if you just bought the underlying asset, you're really betting on strong Bitcoin per share growth in the future by the company.
That's right.
Where I think at its peak it was 2x or a little north of 2x. And so whereas now I think it's slightly under 1x.
Mm-hmm. Under?
I think so.
Oh, okay.
We should all double check those numbers. Anyone listening should double check those numbers. But it's certainly on the order of half range, of what it was. Yeah. And so that's a very important metric to understand as well. If you buy into this thesis, well, your entry point does matter. And it appears to be comes and goes with bull and bear markets. In a bull market, it's going to be a high premium. And then also Strategy has a lot of control there too, because if they don't want too large of premium to exist, they can sell a lot of equity and make it disappear. So they are in control of that. To a large degree.
Yeah. And I think that that's important as well. When people describe the company MicroStrategy, you know, I think looking at MNAV, I mean, it's a metric, but I think it just gets people going down the wrong path, because then you start comparing it to like ETFs. And by the way, the ETF, you're actually paying them 0.25% just to like every year just to hold your stuff. And so it's kind of interesting in a way. And I definitely understand the Bitcoiner skepticism of banking, because in a way it kind of does feel like, and I acknowledge your point, Steve, you have to watch this stuff very carefully. Because it kind of feels like, all right, you know, Bitcoin are saying, I can't believe people went into banking. It's such a scam. It's like, why not just pay the guy to hold your gold and you'll pay him a fee? It's like, well, you have that option. That's the ETF.
Right.
But on the other hand, then a banker comes along and is like, you know, you're paying this guy to hold your gold? You can just give me that and I'll give you a little cut too. Right. And so my guess is it starts off in an amazing, you know, way. And my original point was, think of this as a company that specializes in basically stacking more Bitcoin. Or, you know, Saylor calls it refining digital capital into credit. And then he always has these kind of like cheesy. They're cheesy, but I kind of like these like photos of like him out in like the like, you know, Permian Basin out there as like a Texan refining the natural gas and oil. But to be clear, I could see this as the kind of thing where for the next 5-10 years, it's amazing. You increase your Bitcoin per share. It's an excellent play. But I could also see in the 100-year time frame, you know, could this become the next JP Morgan or, you know, some kind of bank that just slowly, little by little, starts getting a little greedier, a little riskier. And then all of a sudden, it's the same question we asked again, which is, why didn't you just pay the guy to hold your gold? Mm-hmm. Well, because someone was paying me more gold.
I also wanted to respond to Ryan Brown. First of all, he gave a nice shout out. He wants us to talk about this stuff. So again, you know, our audience wants to hear
this
about
you, Ryan.
AI, Bitcoin Core, and Stretch.
We get it all.
So he says $300 billion would be used to buy Bitcoin. I think he's referring to this scenario where I said currently Stretch has $10.5 billion in assets under management. In the scenario where we snap a finger and it goes to $300 billion, I was saying it's much, much riskier then. He's saying, well, wouldn't they just buy Bitcoin to that? Well, Strategy can buy Bitcoin to that. They could put it in the US dollar reserve. They have options. So they don't have a policy where they have to do something, but I think it's fair to say they would mostly buy Bitcoin with it, either 100% or maybe like probably something like 90 to 100%, and the remaining goes into the US dollar reserve. But for simplicity, let's just say yes, they buy all Bitcoin. But the key point, though, Max said earlier that they're aiming to over collateralize their obligations. And with I don't know if they've officially stated an aim of 3 to 1, but that might be the case. But and they're currently 4.5 to 1, so it's even more conservative and safer. Yeah. But if it's 10 billion and they have, let's just say, 45 billion in Bitcoin to back that, if all of a sudden that goes to 300 billion.
Yeah, that's a problem.
And then they have 345 billion of Bitcoin to back it. Obviously, the ratio is dramatically changed. It's effectively 1 to 1. It converges on 1 to 1, which completely changes the risk profile. And then all of a sudden, you know, in that kind of extreme scenario, that would be crazy risky, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So the growth of Stretch needs to be commensurate with the appreciation of Bitcoin, because the flip scenario is like the $10 billion in Stretch. Let's say no one else buys any more Stretch. It just stays at $10 billion, but Bitcoin goes to $200K. So it like triples. Well, all of a sudden now that $45 billion goes to like near, you know, $140 billion or whatever, $135 billion. So you get like a crazy ratio of over collateralization. So then you could be super comfortable growing Stretch to, right? In my opinion, comfortable. I mean, if you're comfortable today, let's say anyone comfortable today, you would be comfortable then with $30 billion of Stretch. And it's the same risk factor.
Yeah. One thing I want to mention just in going down my own rabbit hole, I recommend watching Saylor's presentation at the Bitcoin conference because I think it's very good. And one thing that I didn't really fully appreciate is, you know, the pieces that he put together to do this, in some ways, it actually reminds me a little bit of Bitcoin. Because Bitcoin itself was not like some grand new discovery about the nature of the universe, but it was the ability to sort of cobble together in a unique way a lot of existing technologies, which together opened up this incredible new possibility, public-private key cryptography, hash cash, you know, I don't know, all kinds of things.
Work,
proof of work. Yeah. All these different
most
technologies.
Most great technologies really are that.
And yeah.
I think people who aren't close to the metal don't realize that.
Yeah.
But every example you ever see is just basically assembling stuff that kind of mostly already there in a new novel way and making it useful in a new way.
Exactly. And that is creativity. And by the way, another aside, which we should touch on in a minute, is I got to sit in this very chair yesterday and do a rip with our compatriots, Dustin and Jesse's new AI podcast yesterday. We talked a lot about this question of like, you know, the ability for AIs to be creative through synthesis or like mashups, remixes of existing things versus, I think there is another category of innovation, which is sort of the Nikola Tesla divine inspiration. That's an interesting debate, but regardless, there's clearly a ton of room in many
when
examples.
When Nikola Tesla was doing that, it's happening in several places at once, right?
Exactly. And in fact, there's a lot of people that are, well, There's some debate about the noosphere.
Okay.
Maybe, but I do think there are some examples of like genuine new sort of quantum 0 to 1 leaps.
Yep.
But I think, let's say, the majority of cases, and certainly AI is capable of doing remixes. But anyways, the point I wanted to make is if you go to see Saylor's slide where he talks about this, I mean, he combines a lot of things that are pretty old school and he actually used AI to do it, right? So he found this new synthesis of things like, okay, well, you know, perpetual preferred equities, that's something that's been around for a long time, you know,
Shelf registration.
Yeah. There's all these different sort of financial or legal technologies, which by themselves are kind of boring and unsexy, when mashed up in a new way, create this incredible new product.
And it wasn't the first thing, right? It was first like the convertible bonds, or maybe it was first even just the common equity, and then it was convertible bonds, and then it was like Strike and Stride and
Strife or
whatever,
something.
Strife, So it's like this kind of, it's almost like this tweaking, tuning, like it kind of works, but not quite. And then this part of it is broken and maybe we can fix it by adding a little bit of this. It's typical kind of product development in a sense. It just happens to be this is like a financial product, right?
Exactly. And it's real engineering. And that's what I don't think people appreciate. Yeah. And I really love hearing when Saylor talks about this because he's so much one of us, right? He's sitting there talking about it. He's like, we're taking the amplitude and we're just squeezing it down. And you're like, yes, like keep going. Tell us about how you're taking our sine wave and stretching that. And I don't know. It's really interesting. And I do want to also give credit on that point. You know, historically, I have been, and generally still agree with this, bullish on strategy, extremely bearish on all the other treasury asset or treasury companies or whatever, because I think most of those guys were basically, you know, the Saylor playbook in a bull market of just like sell to like your MNAV is 2 to 1. You can keep selling equity, bring it down. Like, great. That works in a bull market. I think most of these guys have shown they probably don't know what they're doing in a bear, with some exceptions, you know, like Metaplanets in Japan, blah, blah, blah. But I do have to give credit to the homie Punter Jeff, who's always putting out good content. And
just because of the CoffeeZilla interview?
Yeah, the CoffeeZilla interview made that guy a legend. I feel bad for Coffee. I mean, he just, yeah, that was rough. But Strive, I think, is the name of the company. Or it's
Strive, yeah. Vivek is their stretch.
Vivek Ramaswamy's company. They have another real innovation, which I think in our discussion this week, a lot of people were even surprised they figured out how to do this, but which was how to go from paying the dividend once a month. Sailor was doing a vote to go to 2 times a month, but they figured out how to do it daily with overlapping registrations, which is itself super unsexy and like kind of like a boring technical detail, but unlocks a really big deal because when you can pay things daily, there's no incentive for someone to come buy it, sell it. There's less arbitrage potential. And so it creates a lot more stability.
Which is more value to the common holders, right?
Exactly. And
it corrects that value leak.
Exactly. Yeah. And it also potentially, and I think when you start thinking of these, and I would be surprised if Strategy doesn't match that as well, that innovation. Yeah. But then, you know, it starts to build, and again, something else in the history of technology is it's like, it's always layered. You have one technology, another technology, mash them together, and now there's a new layer, and you can put something on top of it. TCP/IP, HTTP, Bitcoin, Lightning, Cashew, or however you want to think about it. And in this case, I think once you have that stability, then it makes it a lot easier, I think, to offer other kinds of products like the yield coins on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That's enough strategy.
Is there ever enough strategy?
You raised proof of work, right?
Yeah, let's do that.
Or the security, like...
Yeah.
So I think Max, you shared this week discussion of, I actually forget the exact context, you can fill it in, but maybe it was like people using proof of work to do beneficial, useful work towards AI.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll need to fill in the blank.
Sure.
But we've certainly heard this over time too.
like
can we solve some
future man
health research
issues? Can we, like, at the
cure,
firm.
Can we cure right. cancer by doing SHA-256 hashes?
Right.
Or is there a substitute algorithm for proof of work that also cures cancer or helps society in some other way?
Yeah.
And you know, at first blush, most people probably would say that sounds great because proof of work just seems super wasteful. Why spend all this energy on that? If we can also cure cancer, that sounds incredible.
Could you please stop blowing the oceans?
So, once you study proof of work,
it's for slop, we're good.
You realize it's not wasteful. It's serving a purpose, and it's very and for it to serve its purpose, it needs to be singular in its value.
Yeah.
And that is generating these random numbers so that everyone has a fair random opportunity to mine the next block. And anything that distracts it from that, if it can do other stuff, that actually weakens the security of Bitcoin.
And weakens the
security
you mentioned
of
fairness.
Proof of work.
It's the fairness, really, right?
What do you mean by that?
Well, you mentioned fairness, but I think that's not to be sort of glossed over because, like, if you have a way to do proof of work and also do something else, then the rest of the world that doesn't have that also something else, they're just competing with you on like the proof of work, and you're always going to beat them because you can make more money, buy more hash power with like whatever hot tubs you're filling or heating or whatever.
Well, that's actually something important to touch on because we have that.
Heat is actually probably
there's
one exception.
Fairness, yeah. and then it bleeds into security as well. Because if I can make a capital expenditure, billions of dollars of something that is like, has some value to society other than Bitcoin, and then I can just like flip a switch and switch it to Bitcoin and back, my ability to attack the network is much greater, right? I mean, what if I had 51% hash power, but on just a normal day, I'm curing cancer whatever.
Peace, y'all. Be back.
Benefit to society. And then all of a sudden, I want to like reorg the blockchain, or I want to take down Bitcoin, or I want to like... short Bitcoin or whatever my obviously weakens security. So there is no question in my mind, fundamentally, it's incompatible to have proof of work to do other stuff in this pure theoretical sense. And certainly at some magnitude, it is very weakening and bad for Bitcoin. Hot tubs, heating, swimming pools, etc. That's useful work.
Why is that different?
So I don't think it's different in the theoretical purist sense. Mm-hmm. I think it also, I have no issue with that happening at a small scale for a couple of reasons. One, if it remains at a small scale, like I am skeptical there's going to be 51% of hash rate that's heating hot tubs.
I actually might push back on that.
I haven't run the numbers, yeah. But my instincts are...
I want to hear how you get
as that. A hot tub maximalist, well, actually, I'm saying
that. How many gigawatts power hot tubs heating?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But I mean, diffuse, I doubt not just hot tubs, but like...
Other heat related?
Any kind of heat related. We can come back to this.
I mean, that's a worthwhile analysis. Yeah, I mean, we're talking about hot tubs, but just overall heating, if they're, you know, what's the market size of gigawatts there and like how much of that is addressable by Bitcoin miners? I don't know. But if it does scale and becomes very popular, then I actually would be concerned. If we're literally sticking to like people's swimming pools, ohms or whatever, then I'm not concerned. But another reason I would not be concerned about that is that it would be super distributed.
Exactly. That's right. Where we're at.
So if there's like 100 million people or a billion people's hot tubs or...
That's where we're going.
Or I don't even know how many hot tubs are sold. But let's say 200 million people around the world with their pools and hot tubs.
You get a hot tub? You get a hot tub.
They are all heated by saturated market. Then it's hard...
They're all heated by a single player.
Hard to believe that all these homeowners would collude to switch off the heat and or you're, you know, and like attack Bitcoin or whatever, like
okay. Heat itself does not transmit well. You can't transmit it over a wire like you can with like electricity or communication. You can transmit over wires. Heat you can't transmit over a wire because they have to use it at the place it's happening.
I think there's another reason too, and I think there's a few things to break down on this. But while we're on the subject of heat, I'm not an expert on this, but I know there's a whole movement. We actually had one of these. What do you call himself? The heat punks at our Type 1 summit. Very cool name, by the way. It's a very interesting rabbit hole. But I would argue maybe my initial reaction, the one thing that's different about heat is, you know, I always say all of my like sort of like beliefs about Bitcoin stand so long as we keep the laws of thermodynamics in place. With ASI around the corner, who knows? Maybe that breaks. But as of right now, there is no way to do computation without creating heat. Full stop. And so that's Landauer's principle, right? There's this idea, and this actually gets very interesting if you really push things to their limits of, you know, you can mathematically prove, you know, whatever, what the minimum amount of heat generated is from manipulating one bit of information. That's a fascinating rabbit hole. But the point is, I don't think there is any form of computation, given the laws of thermodynamics, that would not give off heat. So that would be my answer, is just like that is going to happen with whatever algorithm you choose. And so therefore it's just a given, given the nature of computation. But I think to give a bit more context with this, cause I had multiple people reaching out to me, I guess I'm the guy that's like shat on things like BitTensor or whatever enough, but you know, saying, hey, you know, this new Pearl thing, Pearl coin from Together AI. Together AI is like a pretty reputable company.
Is that real? They have a coin now?
That's what I'm saying. That was my reaction too. I know exactly.
I hadn't heard it.
But when I saw that, I was
You're not even on Twitter.
I know. So Together AI is one of these clouds. And I don't know if like they're specifically pumping their own coin yet, or if they're supporting this Pearl network. Somehow there's a partnership there. My initial reaction is as soon as I hear there's a coin, like short that company, but we'll see. Not financial advice. But basically they do have a very legitimate team of like actual physicists or whatever behind this. And it's exactly like Steve said, and similar to what the BitTensor folks have been saying for a long time, wouldn't it be cool if we could do proof of work, which is actually, basically proof of like useful computation. I agree with all the arguments Steve just made. To resynthesize in my own language, you know, the example I always give is that it's not that having some additional use cases totally preclude you from being a monetary good, but they compete with the value of being a monetary good. So gold and silver, both monetary goods, both have industrial use cases as well. I would argue, you know, that it distorts the price of those two goods. And in many ways, that's probably, you know, obviously
having the industrial use case distorts it.
Exactly. And so that's probably an additional reason other than pure scarcity that gold has done better than silver, is that silver price fluctuates a lot more historically because it's being used in all kinds of industrial applications. Now gold is starting to be used in more industrial applications. For example, in solar panels, there's, I guess, trace amounts of things like gold and silver used, and those are about to, you know, if you know my views on that, continue to skyrocket. So I would argue that the industrial use cases never gave gold or silver their monetary value. They distracted from it. And
I
made
think
them,
it just bootstrapped it. It kind of like made a reason for some people to want it, need it, and generated some initial demand. And then it kind of took off.
Maybe. I mean, that's certainly possible. I mean, there's another kind of, I mean, who knows, right? Because this all started so long ago. There's another theory that people just saw, ooh, shiny thing. And we're kind of like wired innately to value scarcity because it's beautiful. I mean, there's a lot of theories. But regardless, you know, the beauty, having it be quote unquote wasteful for Bitcoin is a feature, not a bug. It makes, like you said, a lot harder to, you know, have a nefarious actor, collect the hash rate, all those things. But also, I think it's important to note that when you choose an algorithm to be useful, that algorithm is not going to be constant. And this is also very important. In the Pearl discussion, from what I saw, they're already talking about in the future, they're going to need to effectively hard fork to have a new algo to follow whatever sort of like the new ASICs are for AI, whatever the new sexy computation that needs to
be
done.
Kind of Monero, constantly changing.
Exactly. And so at that point,
who decides how we change?
Exactly. And as much as Monero is a beautiful project in many ways, like their constant hard forks to try and keep it, you know, at the CPU level, frankly, is just a terrible design decision. And so I think anyone that's trying to...
And that was stated and obvious at the time they were debating it by Bitcoiners. And it resonated with me right away.
Yeah.
It just boggles my mind that other smart people went down that path.
Let them know, Steve. Let that look at your face.
I mean, like, Monero is one of the more respectable... It's one of the more respectable...
Yeah. It has some things I think are better than Bitcoin, some properties, but this is not one.
But that was a really bad decision, I think.
Yeah. So anyways, so if anyone's listening to this, TLDR, if someone tells you they have a useful proof of work, probably you should run.
I know we wanted to expand this to the big picture question of like security budget. So I can provide a little bit of context there, and then we should get back to Vinny's last statement in a minute. But a little bit of context. So I think most people in Bitcoin understand that Bitcoin security depends on mining. People are familiar with like the 51% attack and that it can reorg the chain. And, and that's bad if that happens. bad things happen. And then in 2018, I think it was, Eric Budish, who's a professor, at least at the time, professor at University of Chicago, did a pretty thoughtful analysis, because certainly at the time, most professors weren't super thoughtful or of their understanding of Bitcoin. But it was a thoughtful analysis of the security budget. And so he analyzed it. And if you read it, at first blush, it seemed thorough and well-reasoned. But he came up with answers of like, in the future, the fees per Bitcoin transaction will be like $18,000 fees per transaction. For it to be secure. So, I mean, when you hear that, you're like, well, either that sounds ridiculous or, oh my God, Bitcoin's going to die or it's not going to sustain. So it certainly warrants further investigation. So a group of us did study at the time. In fact, that's when I first met Nick Carter. Flew to Boston, met with him and a bunch of other folks to study it. And that's when I realized, wow, this is a really complex topic of what the security budget needs to be. Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about that. Let's now bring up Vinny's comment, which is, mining doesn't actually seem to scale with energy, though. Access to the latest ASICs is a stronger predictor of hash rate than cost of energy. But so one comment I'd have is like, people often point to hash rate and like, oh, it's like this many exahashes now and it's grown this much and stuff. But the security is about the financial cost to attack, not the hash rate. Now, hash rate's a pretty good proxy. But I mean, just to make that very clear, though, let's say that all of a sudden today a new ASIC chip were created or brought to market that's 10 times more efficient. Mm-hmm. And costs the same as what the current ASICs cost. Well, it just got a whole lot cheaper to participate, but also attack the network. And the hash rate didn't change. So it's not like the hash rate had to like be reduced by 10x. So it's the financial cost to attack, which is the real metric. And these other things are just proxies. Mm-hmm. Now let's get into, you know, why was Budish's model too simplistic? It assumed that you could rent the hardware sort of at will. Mm-hmm. And that's not reality. Now, GPU-based or other cryptocurrencies that use a proof-of-work algorithm that wasn't big enough or for whatever, or either was anti-ASIC or ASIC-resistant, because there are algorithms that are ASIC-resistant. That was another thing that at the time people thought was a smart idea, mm-hmm. and I never really thought was a smart idea. But there's, for whatever reason, they're GPU-based, and they're definitely, like, NiceHash rents GPUs like crazy. So, and several...
Ethereum, right? Ethereum is still... Well, I guess they got off of mining entirely, but where they did.
Yeah, but there were also ASICs for Ethereum. So, okay. But there was GPU usage in Ethereum proof of work for post-2014, yeah. Which is when it was the end for Bitcoin. Yeah. Anyway, there definitely have been cryptocurrencies that have been double spent and reorged from people renting hash rate or renting GPUs from NiceHash. That's happened. So that's like historical record. But you can't do that with Bitcoin. I mean, in theory, this market could exist, but there's never been a market to be able to get 51% of the hash rate just from like my laptop or phone and rent all that. So it's...
Is that because of the specificity of the ASIC is designed kind of to do the Bitcoin hashing and not as a general purpose, whereas other people provide general purpose like GPUs available?
That's probably a dynamic, but it's also just like, you know, these Bitcoin miners that invest 100 million or 500 million in their mining farms, they're not in the business of renting it out. They're in the business of mining and making money. So,
like they have to amortize their capex across time.
Yeah. Right? That's one big difference, and from theory to reality, that's one thing that blows up that theory. I also think, let's say that the market does, I don't think it'll evolve this way, but let's say it evolves to where miners who have made large investments or whatever, but they do start making their hash rate available for rent, then it would open up. Because another thing, there's some website that shows the cost to attack each chain, and it's always shown like just millions of dollars to reorg Bitcoin, and I'm always like scratching my head. Yeah. But it's because of this. If you can theoretically rent equipment on demand only for like a few hours, then it would cost whatever, some tens of millions of dollars. You could reorg the chain, and then you could have made this shorter and whatever investment and try to make money. But so even if we're in a situation where miners or that you can actually do that, rent the equipment, and pulled it off, like miners are going to quickly stop doing that, right? They've invested $500 million of their own money in their own business, which is what they care about. And if Bitcoin's being attacked and the price is dropping because it's being attacked, they're not going to rent their equipment anymore.
Right.
So it would be, even in that scenario, I just view it as like a one-time oopsie and then like stop doing that. Another part of that model by Budish that, didn't take into account is like price elasticity. And so like if my intention is to attack the network and I have to acquire all this equipment, the price per ASIC that I'm buying off the market, I mean, I can only buy so much new equipment and then I have to go buy other people's existing equipment. That price goes up over time. Yeah. And if we're talking about 51% of the market, it's going to...
Word gets out.
It's word gets out. Well, even word gets out or not. I mean, just the willingness to sell goes down. Or I mean, like the first person probably is looking to sell. And then like the 51st percent, the person's like doesn't want to sell. Their price is going to be higher. So that was not taken into account. Then another thing was like the practicality of actually like acquiring that much energy. It's a lot of, I mean, it's like 10 gigawatts or something. And so you don't just like from your phone or laptop sign up for 10 gigawatts. You have to go like do deals with lots of different energy companies. And you're first of all, you're KYCing there probably. And you're like signing some 10-year contract. And this isn't like a few hour, like, oh yeah, I just want 10 gigawatts for a few hours. Right. Will you give that to me? And then like you pull off an attack and then, all right, see ya. So there's just so many things that make this way more complicated model. My conclusion from all this is, first of all, the Budish model is too simple.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's nearly impossible to model out what the security budget even needs to be. Because it's a very interesting question, though, because to date, 99% of the revenue from mining, which goes into paying for security, has been the Coinbase reward. And that's going to go to zero. And then it's only fees.
Yeah.
So to date, people are indirectly funding the security budget just based on how much they're willing to pay for Bitcoin. But when people buy Bitcoin, whether you bought it at $1,000 or $10,000 or $100,000, you're not thinking about, oh, I'm paying for the security budget. That's not part of your calculus. So right. It's just an artifact of that.
Right.
In the future, it's going to be solely based on transaction fees. But I would say, so it's a very different dynamic. So history does not teach us what that will look like. But I would also argue in that future, you're still not thinking about the security budget. You'll think about it more, I think, because it'll become more relevant. But the reason I pay a higher fee is because I want to get my transaction in a block, and I'm only going to pay a higher fee if others are paying a higher fee. And then it's an auction, yep. Right? That's why I'm going to pay a higher fee.
And that's the beauty of Bitcoin. It's self-interest.
Yeah, works. But it is misaligned with security budget. I think that's a design flaw of Bitcoin. Fundamental design flaw. I don't know if it's going to be like a fatal flaw, but it is a design flaw because there's not alignment on participants are not aligned with paying for the security budget.
If you were to rewind the clock and start it again, how would you fix that flaw? Like, would you just slow down the Coinbase rewards and dole them out over a longer period, or somehow create some sort of scarcity or sort of like difficulty adjustment? And
I don't think
internal emission,
tail emission, or doing. I think that's they're all equivalent, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, because another fundamental debate here is like, who should pay for the security budget? Because like, if someone bought 10 years ago, self-custody, mine their Bitcoin and haven't just hodl, don't touch it, don't use Bitcoin at all beyond that, just hodling.
Right.
Well, they paid back then, but they're not. There's no ongoing cost to them, and yet they benefit from everyone else paying fees because it just stacks the proof of work on top of their block. But they're not paying for it. So it's the current transactors are paying for security for everyone. And so you can get into a debate about should everyone be paying? I think it's a completely reasonable debate.
Yeah.
So
it's a slippery slope.
So that's where tail emission or some form of tax or fee on everyone who has a UTXO, you can definitely argue is fair. But I mean, I think it's debatable which is better there. And at this point, you know, we're not going to change it.
Right.
I don't think that's clearly better. I think it's a reasonable proposal or thought exercise, but I don't see it as like clearly better either.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, it's a really good framing, and I don't think there's a clear answer to this. However, my intuition, you know, I think I used to be, you know, years ago, more in the tail emission camp. I think over time, I'm much more in the camp of, you know, absolute scarcity, it matters more. And that, I'm not sure I would call it a flaw. I mean, maybe, we'll see over time. But I'm not sure there is a perfect design, right? Because if you had the tail emission or some sort of tax on UTXO holders, then you kind of leave open the opportunity for another, basically, project to undercut that. It's like, well, you know, if you want to store your wealth here, you know, it's kind of like you could do the ETFs and pay the 0.25% fee, but then that leaves open the opportunity for someone else to undercut you and say there's 0% fee, or we'll make you Bitcoin. So I think in my mind, and maybe this is hand wavy, but I've never really worried because I believe that Bitcoin will find enough users. It may not be individual UTXO holders, maybe it's going to be the businesses. But increasingly, I will say, hearing you say that, I did have a bit of a eureka. You know, I know Jack is always saying, if we don't use it as money in some way, shape, or form, then eventually it will die. And, you know, I've always kind of got that at some level, but I think that really viscerally clicked for me where it's true. Like, if you wanted to take the very sort of like cynical, skeptical approach, then ETFs, MicroStrategy, all these sort of corporate stackers, you know, it's not an overnight attack, right? But if you look at it on a decade or even century long time frame, it is a way to potentially kill Bitcoin because over time, if there's not enough, and I don't think it has to be individuals. In fact, I find it highly unlikely.
Just some sort of on-chain activity.
Exactly. Yeah. I find it highly unlikely individuals are going to be using the blockchain ever, frankly. I think it's going to be businesses, banks, you know, whatever. Maybe if you're buying a house, you use Bitcoin on-chain, but like for your day-to-day, I just don't ever see a world where you're using Bitcoin. But there's going to be, in theory, if there's not a demand, robust, robust demand and market for block space over time, then the project will die. There's people talking about doing on-chain zaps now,
which we let's, if we have time, talk about that because I think it's insane.
My brain can't, I would actually like to talk about that,
but let's not interrupt the current conversation because there's definitely a few more things I want to say about security model.
I was going to say, I think it feels like every time there's a thing that requires block space, like opening Lightning channels, then people get all concerned that that's going to overwhelm all the block space.
Whenever there's concerns,
I'm literally hearing both sides.
Yeah, I know.
Of there's not enough demand and there's too much demand. Yeah. And I mean, because there's validity to both concerns. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a demand maximalist. Just give it all to me. Like, but there's as much as possible.
There is, I think, a little more sophisticated critique is that when you have a situation where something doesn't scale to a certain amount of demand, then that demand's going to be zero if you don't have a sweet spot in between. And I think that's a reasonable discussion to be had, but I'm not worried. Well, I do, Bitcoin fails without sufficient demand,
right,
given the block size. And I continue to be an optimist and believe, because I think for Bitcoin to succeed, people need to value its unique attributes. It has many strong, unique attributes. The demand for them is still to be determined, because the reality is today, there's still very weak demand for the Bitcoin network usage.
Yeah.
The evidence to date suggests weakness. Yeah. And we should acknowledge that. It continues to be weak. The mempool is like near empty. The only time it's been a strong fee market is a 2-week window in December 2017 when there was the buying frenzy to 20K and people moving funds on chain. But that type of activity has gone away because exchanges are using Lightning and users are using Lightning Network. And number two, a lot of people are just buying and selling ETFs or strategy or whatever.
So you're saying you and your team are the reason we don't have that.
And then the ordinals craze or whatever. So anyway, but I remain optimistic in the future on that demand.
I want to take maybe a slightly different position on this. I didn't think this was going to be spicy, but maybe it's spicy. I'm a demand maximalist. Like, give it all to me. Like, as much as humanly possible, like, bid the price up ASAP. And the reason for that is, to me, it's the same as the security budget. I want as much security as possible. And trying to find even a sweet spot we want to keep fees low so normal people can use it, to me, is the same argument as trying to we want to have ASIC resistant mining, or sort of like the Bcash argument back in the day of, we want to make sure normal people can use the Bitcoin blockchain. And to me, I think those always come from very well-intentioned places, but that's usually coming from hobbyists, from the early Bitcoiners saying, we want to make sure we have access and normal people have access to the chain. It's like, look, dude, if this thing is going to work, normal people will not access the chain. They never will. And that's okay.
So two thoughts on that, though.
Yeah.
The point of bid it up, we want as strong of security as possible. Two thoughts. One, we don't know how to model it, and we don't know what the security budget needs to be. Mm-hmm. Does it need to be $50 billion a year? Mm-hmm. Does it need to be $100 billion a year? $200 billion a year? We don't know. I kind of feel like $50 billion a year is probably enough. You could definitely do some analysis and be like, well, if it's X amount of dollars, if it's high enough how would you attack it? Here's how I'd go about it. And it's like, oh, that's super complex operationally complex or financially costly. No one's really going to do that. So then you get comfortable with some threshold, but we don't really know. So first of all, I think it's just it's theoretical until you start getting, you get attacked once, and then if you sustainably are attacked, well, then you know the floor. Right. I guess I would argue a little bit with this theoretical, as much as possible. Because, even though we don't know what it is, let's say $50 billion a year is what it is. So do I think spending $200 billion is better than $100, or $500 is better than $200, or we just keep paying more and more? No, that's a economic waste for the society, I think.
Well, so I would disagree with that, and here's why. I mean, you can say that from the abstract principle, and that's a debate to be had. My argument is, if people are paying for it, it's not a waste.
No, I disagree. I mean, first of all, we don't know this, but if we knew, mm-hmm. 50 billion is all you need.
Yeah.
If we just knew that,
yeah.
Then if society is paying 500 billion, that is economic waste.
Yeah, but like again, I mean, I just think that this stuff is going to happen emergent from the bottoms up, and like we can always have a model of what we think is right, but there's always like factors we can't put into the model, right? And actually, one of them that I want to talk about, which we didn't touch on, I'm not as concerned on the sort of like economically rational attack on Bitcoin. What I'm more concerned that I don't see enough people talking about is sovereign attack. So I'd be curious to hear your take.
Sovereign attack?
Yeah. So like, okay, forget economically rational actions. Let's say the United States or China, like the two biggest countries in the world, one of them wanted to 51% attack the network. They were able to potentially make chips in secret. They were able to attack the chain indefinitely and lose money and not care.
Yeah, we can go down that. Yeah. But one more thought, though, on this security budget is that, again, we can talk about what the threshold is. Maybe people want to overpay, but that's not what people are going to do because you're not incentivized. You're incentivized in the abstract mm-hmm. to provide security, but in your own individual action of I'm doing this one transaction,
yeah.
what you're incentivized to do is pay the least amount of fee to get in the next block.
Totally. And
or to get in a block in the next day or week or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's just indirect from everyone's action, the security budget we get.
Totally.
So it's more, I think Bitcoin will survive if there's sufficient usage and demand.
Exactly.
Which creates a certain security budget, which just happens to be enough. And that's why I'd call it like a flawed design, but I think it'll work out.
Well, and to me, maybe I just have more faith in this stuff, but I mean, to me, that is just like, it's emergent intelligence from a market. Like there's no way to know this from above. I don't think so. Like, I think
it's just a side effect, unintended side effect, but I think it'll work out.
Well, I think all great systems.
Also the nature of who chooses to mine. I hope in the future, there are no big corporate miners.
Yeah.
Like that seems like a possibility.
If it's all heat punks, let's go.
Yeah. Actually, that's a whole other thing too.
Like category.
And also stranded energy. If you look at the amount of stranded energy in the world, it's like crazy amounts. And there's so many examples of where you literally get paid money to consume energy.
Yes.
So we already know that Bitcoin miners seek out the cheapest possible energy. When you only have like two costs, hardware and energy, as a business person, it's very clear where you're going to spend your time optimizing. You're also in the most cutthroat industry ever because it's like no bearish to entry for the most part. So you're going to, there'll always be this pressure to seek out cheap energy. So if there's energy that is like cost 2 cents or 0 cents or you're paid money to consume it, you're going to go to that. So it just seems to me like over time Bitcoin mining will just consume all the stranded energy.
Yes.
And then it's constraint. The constraint is the hardware costs. And then that's another, when you're analyzing how to attack the network, you have to consider that future too.
And Block is solving that. Maybe over time.
With
chips. So I would say, I actually think there's a very important point to touch on here, which we could have a whole show just on this. I have had many people reach out to me. And you actually shared that article, which I like, the Here Be Dragons article. I guess the guy that's being rolled into 21, large miner Electron. I think that was him. Anyways, one thing that I've had LPs reach out about, friends reach out about, is this idea, and I think it's worth acknowledging and being realistic about it, that we are in a hash rate bear market. That's a fact. Historically, Bitcoin hash rate has increased, you know, on every 6-month period, every year-long period, by double-digit percentage points. And for the first time, you know, we went over, I think, 1 zeta hash or whatever a year ago on, I think, a whatever 90-day moving average. And right now, it's like 900, in the 900s of exahashes. I didn't check today specifically, but somewhere in there.
Down 10% or so?
Something like that. And so I think it's worth pausing to acknowledge, this is a new thing in Bitcoin, or at least new thing since I've been around, and or at least since it's been, you know, an industrial asset class. Now, in the long run, I'm not super concerned. I will say in the short run, there is no question what's happening is, all of the Bitcoin miners are shifting a portion or all of their business into AI compute. No question.
Mm-hmm.
All of that is happening. As a brief aside, which I think is very interesting, we've talked about the situational awareness homie Leopold, who I think I've gotten his name wrong in the past, but he, you know, it's funny, like he just had his own filing for his fund and like he now owns like basically every public Bitcoin miner. He's bought them all now. CleanSpark, Riot, I think Riot was a new addition. So basically he's extremely long energy for AI, although interestingly, some of those companies like both Riot and CleanSpark still have Bitcoin on the balance sheet. That's its own interesting rabbit hole, right? I think the best energy company is an energy company that both owns their own energy assets, but like in not exactly a Saylor fashion, but let's say a Saylor derivative can use Bitcoin as an asset to get more of a depreciating asset dollars to build more energy. That's an interesting sort of flywheel. But the big takeaway is that, yes, these guys that have access to PPAs, have access to, you know, megawatts or gigawatts of energy are unplugging miners and plugging in GPUs, no question. And that is a concern short run. Do I think it's going to lead to a death spiral? Absolutely not. I do think there should be more analysis on this. Like, what is the necessary security budget at any time? Like, how much is that a concern, the hash rate falling? But what we are seeing happen is, you know, most of those machines, not all, clearly 10% have not plugged back in, but most of them are getting plugged in. They're just getting plugged in at the edges. And so instead of being big centralized companies that are plugging in, you know, we've seen distribution. And I think River had a great graphic of this in their report to places like Paraguay, Kazakhstan, Ethiopia, like all of these places where they have super cheap hydro, super cheap solar, Argentina, flared methane in Patagonia. And that to me, at first I was pretty concerned watching the AI shift, but now I'm actually like pretty happy because in the long run, that's decentralization.
Yeah, AI is going to decentralize this stuff.
Exactly. Right? Like the big story with AI is it's just making the network more diffuse.
Yeah. Which is good. We like that.
We like that. So.
So we had comparing Bitcoin forks in our tweet. And I know we're excited to talk about that too. We also have only a few minutes left. So I don't.
Well, I mean, right. But before we jump in that, maybe that would deserve its own discussion. But I do want to hear the comment on the nation state.
Oh, right. Yeah. And also, I don't think we have enough time. We'll have to do comparing forks in a future show because that'll be a really good topic. Probably 20 to 30 minutes to do it justice.
Yeah.
And just to plant the seed, is comparing forks like the core versus knots debate, or that's a
no? There's just many different. The
Paul Stork was it?
There's new thing? There's just many consensus change proposals.
This is recently kind of heated up in some way that wasn't the case.
Well, and also the quantum resistant stuff, right?
That's I mean, OpCat had all kinds of like social media fanfare in 2025 and 2024, and I mean, there's many different proposals. Each has very different characteristics. The genesis of the conversation was like criticism over how Bitcoin Core handles this, and that, you know, like this view that if you, you know, sort of Bitcoin Core decides the proposals or whatever. So I was going to walk through every proposal, sort of describe the characteristics of the proposals, et cetera. But that's why it's not a 5-minute conversation.
Yeah, yeah. It's good we know kind of what we're getting into.
30-minute conversation.
So tell us if we should be worried about U.S. or China attacking New York.
Well, I do. You know, one of the interesting artifacts of the energy environmental concern, especially in 2021 when you and I were, among others, dealing with that, and like responding to it, you know, a classic graph or chart was like more energy consumed than 180 countries or whatever. And I'm like, that's amazing. because like, well, those countries aren't going to attack Bitcoin.
Right.
Because they'd have to redirect their entire country's energy and still wouldn't make a dent into Bitcoin. So there's really only a handful of countries that even have enough energy to attack Bitcoin. And then, of course, even if you have like 20 gigawatts of energy, you're not going to like take all the energy away from your entire economy.
Sorry, citizens, we're going to have a blackout here.
To just adapt. So it needs to be kind of a rounding error. And then, so you're kind of talking about like the US, China, maybe Russia, et cetera. Yeah. So it's a very narrow set just from an energy perspective. Then there's the how do you access the hardware? So yeah, if you're almost any country other than China or the US, how are you going to acquire all that equipment and do it like clandestine? But, you know, like you said, US and China, they've got the energy, they have the money printer, and, you know, and then they can, both countries could absolutely make a bunch of chips in secret. So I really think it just narrowed down to the, like those two countries are the realistic candidates to do such an attack. But as we have seen things, I mean, to date, I think this is, Bitcoin is just not on their radar of like concerns of CCP or the US government. Like if you think about all the geopolitical concerns, Bitcoin is nowhere even remotely on their radar.
Well, I mean,
to date.
We don't know. I mean, it's becoming, we have an administration talking about Bitcoin. We know China's banned.
You're worried about Iran and Taiwan and TSMC and like.
I'm just saying, you never know what's going on behind closed doors.
But I just.
Sufficient amount of paranoia.
Yeah. I think if we could easily list 100 geopolitical issues that are more important to the United States and to China to date, the first 18 years or whatever of Bitcoin than Bitcoin. But we don't know, but that's my opinion. But going to the future. Going forward, if Bitcoin keeps growing and what we think it will do, and it does creep on to the radar, it does make a top 10 priority or whatever, and then all of a sudden, then it maybe is a discussion about, oh, we should kill it because it's a threat to us or whatever. But my argument is like, at that point, there will be so many incentives not to do that. And we already see that happening in the US. Mm-hmm. Like, it has been accepted. Like the adoption of Wall Street is very strong. The adoption of US government is very strong. Like in terms of like advocacy or awareness, talking points, advocacy. But it's also being ingrained in like pension plans now. So it would be politically untenable to like, okay, yeah, like if you're in charge of the United States government and you're like, we're going to kill Bitcoin. And then all of a sudden, like 50 million Americans' pension plans get decimated, the economy declines, the stock market declines, like you're not going to do that. So I think we're already at the beginning of that era where it's a politically dumb move to do that because it's not just like a few early Bitcoiners who get harmed. Because if it's just a few like cypherpunks or early hodlers or whales or something, then it's like,
yeah,
but if it's like
it's in everybody's
tens of millions of Americans, games, yeah. Like yeah. It becomes very politically untenable.
What about China?
It's hard to really know what China thinks of Bitcoin. I mean, they've banned it in various ways over the years. That doesn't necessarily suggest to me though that they don't won't see it as valuable and important. As a geopolitical tool, they're in a position. I mean, the U.S. clearly has an incentive to keep the U.S. dollar king because it's like such a strong weapon and asset and weapon in geopolitics. China doesn't have that, and so China wants that for the yuan, or they at least want a level playing field.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they would prefer their currency to be king. And so, if you're that mindset and you really understand Bitcoin, if you're China, you should like Bitcoin because it's a threat to the US dollar and its supremacy. And they're better off if Bitcoin's strong than if the US dollar is strong.
Better neutral.
And they also happen to be in, you know, they've had a lot of hash rate. They still have.
They still do.
Despite banning it, making it five times. And then like, you know, access to chip. I mean, the three primary ASIC providers are Chinese.
Yeah.
And basically 100% of the market of chips is Chinese.
Yeah.
So,
and block.
I mean,
coming up.
Deployed is 100% Chinese, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like a rounding error right now of proto.
Cool.
So,
don't be worried, ladies and gentlemen. You heard it here.
I don't know. That is like really low on my concern list.
Got it. Cool.
But solar panels in space.
Solar panels in space. Oh, man.
That's where the real mining is going to happen. Right?
Well, hey, on a very positive note, maybe as a little teaser into next week. And I think we need to talk about, we have some AI stuff to catch up on for next week as well.
You'll be happy to know that I'm back on Claude.
Oh, beautiful. Nice. So, AI in space or panels in space. Worth noting this week, a big announcement on my mind. SpaceX filed our IPO and they have been stacking even harder than I realized. I think they have over 18,000 Bitcoin on their balance sheet.
I thought we knew this in 2021.
But was that public? I knew Tesla was public. I didn't know SpaceX had that much.
My conversations with Elon.
Oh, wow.
I was literally having conversations with Elon.
Okay, well, listen. Last night with Jensen, we were talking about how many GPUs we're going to stockpile.
Steve has the receipts. You don't
sorry,
have
sorry. Hold on. Let me just get that for you, Steve.
By the way, before we need to round out because I think you have to go, but yeah. Blue Band Bandit Official.
What a punk.
Says that...
Punk. They said a hunk.
He's my uncle.
His uncle, Terry Rudolph, running Psyquantum.
Runs Psyquantum. Okay.
Did you mention Terry Rudolph?
No. Well, I mean, we did in earlier episodes.
We mentioned Quantum.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, probably reference to Quantum stuff. So.
Yeah.
Alrighty.
All right, guys.
On that, we'll see you next week.
Yeah, see you next week.
No, we won't. We won't. We'll see you on June 1st.
Oh.
Oh, Siri is answering about Terry Rudolph. That's a little creepy.
That's super creepy. Yeah, exactly. What else?
Actually, we should. So we are not doing our regular time next Friday. Mm. But don't worry, you're not going to miss an episode. We'll do the following Monday, June 1st.
So you get two that week.
And then we'll do the Friday, the 5th.
Oh, wow.
All right.
Big week.
Have a great weekend,
everyone.
Have a
good one. Yeah.
Adios. Bye.